Jack, you were saying you were there at Lüneburg.
Well, we were there in Celle, then down to Hanover, then we were in Hanover. Yeah, and my wife and that was living with us. We lived as a family, of course. And then, whilst I was there, it was my first, you know, mentioned court martial experience. There were two field security sections with intelligence corps people, field security sections, and the commander of the brigade, and I was really rather responsible for them, the staff point of view. Two of the NCOs of one of these sections was charged with carrying out a robbery in one of these, a Jewish house. And I won't go into that in any detail because I don't think it's particularly relevant. But the important thing was, it was a very serious offence. One of them was the son of a brigadier, serving brigadier. And the case was basically that they'd been blackmailed because they'd taken part in the raids. We'd got photographs of them being in the underground newspaper. These people were in this Jewish underground newspaper being photographed. So we said the whole thing was a put-up job. And as a result of that, I did a lot of work. I was defending them. And I did a lot of work. We did monitoring of telephone lines from the people involved to see if they were saying things that we could use in defence. And I decided the case was so serious that I would get a counsel. So we got a chap called Duncan Rankin, who became a very famous QC. He came out and defended them. About 3-day trial, court martial.
He flew out from London. He flew out from London.
Oh yes, he came out and defended them. Yes, and so I got involved with that case in some detail. So I certainly began to learn, almost learn from him, the way, you know, the best way of handling a court martial. They were subsequently acquitted, and to cut a long story short, I subsequently learned. Perhaps not for the record, I subsequently learned that one of them had in fact, well, they both had in fact committed the offence, and they fixed their alibis and we'd been conned. That's what it amounted to. I got my own back because one of them was a national serviceman. They were both national servicemen, but one stayed in the army and he was in my own corps. And later on, many, 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 many years later, I won't mention his name, but his name was relevant. When I was the senior officer of the Corps, he came up to me. I didn't know him. And he said, "Do you remember me, sir?" He said, "You defended me in a court martial." And he changed his name. Well, I didn't know him. I knew of him. He was quite well known. He was a warrant officer, class one. And he changed his name because he'd married a German woman. He'd taken, used her name in his, and I hadn't realised. He's a very well-known member of the Corps. Well, he's now dead, but he was a very well-known, very popular member of the Corps. And he said, "You defended me." "Oh, yeah." I just noticed it, because I know he did the job. Now, I knew subsequently. When he came out for a commission, he didn't get it. I stopped it dead. That was him. So he never got what all his colleagues got. Warrant officer class one intelligence corps almost certainly get a commission. He never did. So I got him in the end. However, by the way. Anyway, we were in Celle, and I decided that I was going to join the intelligence corps. So I transferred and I got to come up.
May I interrupt? When did you get your permanent commission?
Well, that was the first stage of it, because I decided I'd join the intelligence corps, and I converted my commission, which was the emergency commission, to what was called a short service, regular commission, for a short service period, 5 years. So I converted that. That was the first stage. I was one of the first to get a regular short service commission, because they didn't just come out. That opportunity had only just arisen. So I did that, and I transferred the intelligence corps with it, and I went to command a field security section, which is really a port security section, in the Hook of Holland. and I was actually based in The Hague, and where I worked on security matters connected with the port and troop movements and things, but with the Dutch security service. I was really working with the Dutch security service and with MI5 because of the links into England and that. And we were used, among other things, as a channel for defectors, British defectors, Russian defectors or Yugoslav defectors, to get them into England, because we used to smuggle them into England, so they avoided all the controls. Sometimes dressed as British soldiers, funny looking people with British uniform. And in that one of those incidents was quite a famous one, because during my time there, there was the trial of the at the International Court of The Hague of the question of the British destroyer that was sunk off the Yugoslav coast by a Yugoslav vessel, off the Albanian coast by a Yugoslav vessel, sunk this British submarine. That was the other way around. It was a British destroyer that was sunk by a Russian Yugoslav submarine. That was a very famous case, and eventually the British government took the Yugoslav government to court, the international court, over the issue. And just before the trial started, the case started, a Yugoslav wireless operator defected. And he was the wireless operator on the submarine when the orders were given. So he was a key witness. Well, we had the job, my unit had the job of getting him from Trieste to the Hague Court as a surprise witness. So we had him in the Hook, we had him in jail, then we had him in prison south there. Looked after rather well, so we wanted him to talk. And then we produced him at the International Court.
How did you get him from Trieste to the Hook?
By military train. Dressed as a military uniform.
You just put him on a train
with people looking after him from my unit, and making certain all the people in charge of the train had nothing to do with it, you know, and weren't allowed anywhere near him. They wouldn't know who he was anyway. They probably thought he was a British deserter being taken back for execution or something. Anyway, we got him to the Hague and produced him there. And he gave his evidence, and of course British won the case. I mean, that was it. Then we had to get him into England, and which we did, you know, military boats and through security service and customs, don't go through customs, stay away from them and that. But that was a part of one was doing all the time, but not all the time, because frequent that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Later on, I mean, when I was back in Germany, I was very much involved with defectors, particularly Russian defectors. I mean, we used to marry these off, you know, to German women, knowing full well they were already married to Russian women. We don't matter about that. We just wanted to keep them quiet and get them back into England.
So you would marry them off to German women?
Yeah. Well, I mean, they probably found a German girlfriend, you see. So,
oh, I see.
And you got them into one of your safe houses, looked after them, while they were going through weeks of interrogation.
And debriefing, and then eventually
debriefing is a polite word, yeah.
Yeah.
And then we'd get them usually into England or to America, Canada, as, you know, usually married, with their five kids still back in Moscow or wherever it was. And of course, if they didn't play ball, they got handed back to the Russians,
which would have led to
execution,
an uncertain fate.
Oh, absolutely, no question about it.
So presumably they would talk. There's no point.
But some of them quite fatalistic. They would go back. I want to go home. I mean, we used to run safe houses where all these people were protected and that. And sometimes they'd get very obstreperous and, you know, want to go. And you used to open the door and say, well, go on in, go. Not certain what they'd do if they walked through it, but They never did, but they did go back. There were several cases where people would go back. And then, of course, you've got British defectors who were in Russian hands, British ones that defected to the Russians. And then they got fed up with Russia, and then they wouldn't come back. And then we used to have them too. So we'd have to interrogate them about, because they were subsequently charged.
And the Russians would release their British defectors, would they?
Usually on an exchange basis.
Right.
So we give one of them back, you know, when we get them back. Yes. That was always on the exchange, not for nothing.
And were you ever present at these debriefings?
I did some of them. Did I did quite a lot. The debriefings of... I didn't do the debriefings of the Russians, because I'm not a Russian interrogator. And we got former white Russians who became British officers who handled them. They were real Russian. I mean, some of my... I have very close friends, you know, members of the Russian royal family and that, who were British, now British officers, and had become British officers at the beginning of the war. And of course, they used to put the fear of God into these, because, you know, suddenly they would be using Russian language that the Russian troops wouldn't quite understand, but they knew it was from the imperial family. So they were looking up to them all the time, no fear of God into them. And we didn't need to use any really hard measures. There were no one used torture or any nonsense like that. That didn't happen. Didn't need to.
And did you have any training?
Me?
Yes. Did you have to?
I was intelligence corps. I had been trained.
You had been trained to do.
Well, I knew all about interrogation and that sort of thing. I just have a flair for cross-examination. That was how I got into Bolton court martials.
So before you get into the court martials, how long were you in this particular type of intelligence
until 1953, doing that particular role.
So from 49-ish
to 53, but I was both in Holland and in Germany, because I eventually commanded a section in Germany, which was the headquarters section in Bad Oeynhausen, the headquarters of BAOR, and we were responsible for the security of the headquarters and to do various operations under command of the headquarters, which, you know, was outside the normal range of things, surveillance all over Europe sometimes of people. So we had surveillance operations, and we were also responsible for the security, British interest security, of the Russian mission. We surveilled them all the time, we kept them under observation. So that was part of my team's job.
And you had some training for this, but you really excelled at it because you feel you had a natural flair.
No, I didn't excel for that sort of work because I had a natural flair. I mean, I'm talking about interrogation techniques or that.
Yes.
You know, I can do that. So because I had a natural flair for it. That was how I got involved with court martials. Because I had this, you know, don't tell me where it came from, I just have it.
And you mainly defended?
I did mainly, oh yes, almost certainly. I did 100 defence cases and a few more prosecutions. I didn't like prosecutions.
Why was that?
Well, as a defence, you could do what you like, couldn't you? But those prosecutions, you're answering for the prosecutor. So you're working to a brief to some extent. My only brief from the defence point of view is what the defendant wants. And you were more constrained. And prosecution, you usually win. I mean, a case doesn't go to court martial until it's pretty certain the person's guilty. I mean, the detail, the work done beforehand, the pre-trial work done is in such detail, people don't go to court martial unless the prosecution's pretty certain they're guilty.
You see, what I was thinking of is that there are some people, who are lawyers, who simply don't take prosecutions, almost on moral grounds. That sounds a little too strong, but almost on moral grounds, because they believe that it is always the Crown's case to prove its case, rather than the defence. That defending is somehow a more ethical business. I don't know whether Did that occur to you?
No, not at all.
No. You see, because you're undertaking something where you said the prosecution mainly wins because the case wouldn't have been brought at court-martial level unless they were going to have a very strong case with a very good chance of winning. So you were undertaking a line of work where the failure rate, if you like, if I could call it that, is very high.
Very high. It's almost lost causes. I mean, the best you can normally achieve, you might get the odd some acquittals, the best thing you can is to make certain the sentence is reduced to the minimum. Put the best possible gloss on the whole thing. So that's your major achievement. Of the 100 cases I defended, many of them were officers. So I got general court martials, many of them were officers. And I suppose I achieved 14 or 15 acquittals.
Out of 100?
About 100, yeah. But I also achieved a lot of very reduced sentences, and almost virtually not a sentence at all. But some of the cases were pretty appalling. I mean, you felt like, why am I defending this person?
Can you give me an example? I was going to ask, what were the sort of offences that officers get themselves in front of a court-martial for?
Insubordination, drunkenness, refusing to obey an order, misappropriating funds, those sort of things. Most of them, almost certainly, not all of them, but most of them involved cashiering. So, I mean, it was pretty serious. So if you could get cashiering reduced to dismissed or dismissed reduced to severe reprimand, you've achieved something. And of course a lot of those ones did. The point was in the court-martial system in Germany, because of the number of troops and because of the number of cases and a certain amount of ill-discipline was pretty prevalent in the late 40s, early 50s, until the reality of a peacetime army sort of hit them. A lot of the, as I said, because of that ill-discipline, a lot of the cases were people who frankly deserved, an appropriate outcome. Now, in my case, having had one or two, I was leading up to saying you'd had this enormous network of permanent presidents of courts martials. They were people usually with legal background, but not always, sometimes just terribly well experienced in this business, who were permanent presidents, who would go around the countryside, almost like Judge Jeffreys in the Monmouth Revolution rebellion. And anyway, they'd have a certain areas they'd operated, and then they would be the permanent president of the court martial, and then the members of the court martial would be assigned by the local formations, brigades, who would detail a battalion, provide X number of officers. Three for general court, for a field general court martial, and five for a general court martial, which officers only have general court martials. But for officers, you'd have also the people called judge advocates. Now, they were proper lawyers, and the judge advocate really is the judge. Although you have a president, and I've done a lot of presidents of court martials in my time, although you have a president, the judge advocate is dictating, and really you're frankly the chairman of the jury to some extent. But for permanent presidents, then there isn't usually a judge advocate. There may be no really legally qualified people in that court martial at all, except the permanent president, as I said, may be legally qualified, he may not be. If you do a lot of court martials, you get to know all these people. You get to know them as well as obviously barristers know judges. So you know exactly what their style is, you know exactly who's going to prosecute. It's not a burden of sight, you know exactly how he's going to handle it. There's always a he, of course. And you get experience of the thing, and they get to know you. They sort of say, oh, you again, sort of thing, and that. And once you've, if you've had, as I did, and others, I'm not the only one, a certain amount of success in getting people off or getting around, someone would hear about this and they say, why don't you get old Captain Fielder or whatever, you know, he'll defend you. And people all over Germany would be, I've got a soldier in my battalion that needs a defence officer, would you be prepared to undertake it? And I found I was in the end doing one or two a week at one time. That became a bit too much, frankly. But you've got to know the system, you've got to know. And you, I mean, I've got law books out and the study there that the same barristers have, you know, the same
archbolds and all the usual. Your regimental duties.
Yeah. You're getting nothing for it, only thanks. Well, perhaps not even thanks if you've got them off, and you certainly didn't get thanks from the prosecution if you've got one of the dreadful criminals away. But
that's always the prosecution's fault.
But you've got rape cases, you've got violent behaviour, robbery, cruelty to animals. It's not unusual. That was another. One of the most unpleasant cases I ever had was an NCO threw a dog out of a sixth-floor window and killed it. Neither defended. And all I managed to do was to, and all I wanted to do, frankly, was to ensure that he didn't go for prison for a couple of years. Instead, he went for 6 months or something. That was about all you could achieve. I didn't like those sort of cases.
Can I just get inside the mind of a defender just for 1 second? That's at one level, it's a very vicious act to do. At another level, there are many worse things than throwing dogs out of windows. But why did you said it was one of the worst cases you dealt with? Why were you, other than professional?
Not the worst case. Unpleasant.
Unpleasant. I'm sorry. One of your most unpleasant cases.
Rape cases are not unusual.
Sorry?
I did a number of rape cases, yes.
Well, we'll come to those perhaps in just a moment. But for this particular dog out of the window case, unpleasant. Apart from professional pleasure, why were you happy to get his sentence reduced from 2 years to 6 months in such a...
Well, I had a duty to him. I was defending him.
Right.
Not for me to judge him, it was the court to judge him, and it was my job to make the best possible use. I mean, any defence counsel will be in that same position. You know, knowing full well the person that he's achieved acquittal for some dreadful murder is probably almost certain to be guilty, but it's not his job to do it. And of course, what you don't want to be told is, I'm guilty.
Of course, because then you're...
Yeah, and you're stuck. Yeah.
Yes.
And... But of course, it was to understand the law, to know the law perhaps a bit better than almost invariably I did. I knew the law better than the prosecution knew the law, and just worry all around the thing. One's interrogation background enabled you to sort of work out the best line to pursue, and to use cross-examination techniques which were aiming to destroy, if possible, the evidence of the of the witness, you know, of the prosecution.
Yes.
Absolutely. And one could prosecute, and you knew your precedents of court martial or your judge advocates, and you knew how far you might be able to go and get away with, you know, and slip in the odd comment which he said, that's how you know that you mustn't say that, but you've already said it, so that's too late.
But you're not influencing the jury though.
You're influencing the officers on the court, of course, are they?
Yes, but would they be influenceable by a comment?
Oh yeah, yeah.
They would be.
Yes, well, I would say in every case, but I'm pretty certain they could be.
Yes.
You found a weakness in the case which you're not allowed now to pursue. And then, of course, you don't know what sympathy they may have had for the accused person anyway.
Yes.
And then, of course, I mean, I've also been as a member of the court as well, and certainly in this country I did quite a few particularly when I was up in Scotland, presidents of court martial myself, and
acting in a traditional capacity
in every case with a judge advocate. No, in Germany not with a judge advocate, but in every case in Britain with a judge advocate, because by that time the system had settled down and you wouldn't have sort of amateurs in a sense doing the president, doing, you know, running the show. So you'd have a judge advocate with you, whose job is to advise you as to the law. But that advice was normally fairly strong. But they mustn't be present when you're considering the sentence. They're not present. And of course, if you're a junior officer on there, the first person's opinion is the junior officer. That's a hell of a job. Because you'll almost certainly be wrong. You're trying to sum up, well, what the hell's going to say? Yes, yes, but I was never in that position, fortunately. I was always the president or something. Here's some junior officer's view, and then have to sort of not agree it.
Were you ever daunted by having to defend where the potential penalty was extremely severe? And I'm thinking of the rape cases that you referred to, which I assume would be probably the worst that you ever had.
Yeah, they could get life.
They could get life. Mm. Were you ever daunted by that?
No, not really. No. I mean, in fact, in most cases, they usually got 2 years or 3 years or something. It was quite modest, really.
Why was that?
Although I know of a different case, which is a different way of doing it. I can go back to Berlin when I was adjutant. One of your jobs in those days, the way court-martial systems worked, they never announced the sentence, or indeed the verdict, at the court-martial. That came later in the rules. At my time of life, comparatively recently, that came in. That the verdict and the sentence was announced. It all had to be subject to confirmation by the commander-in-chief, of course. When these had to be confirmed by the... When that confirmation came through, it was usually the job of the adjutant of any unit to confirm the sentence to the accused, whoever that may be. And in Berlin, we had a number of rather unpleasant cases, usually involving assault and rape. No, not normally, but I mean, we had those sort of cases. And I can remember on one particular occasion... there was the accused standing in front of me, the sergeant major behind him, just been brought in to hear the sentence, been charged with rape. And I can remember saying that, you know, the sentence, when confirmed by the commander-in-chief, is 10 years penal servitude. Now, on this particular occasion, I can remember, I said that sort of thing. And he said, like F it is, and he tipped the table over it. I was in front of me, and he tipped it right on top of me, and I flew backwards and that. And, you know, I was really quite shaken by all this. So I had a drill after that with the sergeant major. They were always about 2 paces away from the table, and I would say something like this. And the sentence of the court was you'd be going to prison for 15 years, march out, sergeant major. Before he had a chance of knowing what it was, he was out of the door. I gave none of them any more chance of of saying something like that. Now, the other one was, you touched on it sometime earlier this morning, about consequences on... The worst situation I ever found myself in was in Celle. There was a case, and I wasn't directly involved in the thing, there was a case of a Polish officer, in fact I think he was a lieutenant colonel, Polish lieutenant colonel, who'd been sentenced to death for execution by firing squad for some offences connected with a prison camp. And my brigade had the responsibility of carrying out this execution. I was told by the staff officer responsible to the brigade commander for this arrangement, it was the Green Howards that were going to carry out the execution, that I had to be the officiating officer. and I'm totally opposed to capital punishment, always have been. And I said, I won't do it. And the chap said, well, you'll realise you'll be cashiered. You can't, you'll have to do it. And I said, well, you can tell the brigade commander I'm not prepared to do it. It was about a week before the execution. I didn't have to do the execution. I had to be there to certify on behalf of the convening officer the execution had been correctly carried out. I said, I'm not prepared to do it. He was, fortunately, he was commuted at about 48 hours before the execution. So never came to me saying, I'm not going, directly. I've often remembered that.
Now, if you yourself had been court-martialed, you would have handled your own defence?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I haven't thought about that.
Would they have court-martialed an officer in those circumstances? It's a very special, unique case.
Yeah.